KBOO's building a city of media makers. For 50 years, KBOO has had an open-door policy and trained anyone for free who is interested to learn to create radio and media. We believe in mutual aid, a reciprocal exchange of resources and services for benefit of all. What a stale place Portland could become if we lose our diversity of voices and our creative climate that emphasizes fun, truth, beauty, joy, peace, love, and justice. We know that, with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city creative, activated, and aware through the radio that we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter, and thank you for your support of KBOO. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 5 p.m. Up next, your evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's Coffee House, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee sandwiches, roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, the state unemployment numbers are in for January.
State and city leaders discuss hiring non-traditional workers.
And a new documentary tackles racism in Portland by looking at last year's hate crimes on the max. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 6th, 2018. I'm Kyle.
And I'm Jasmine. A documentary series on racism in America premiered last night on A&E. It quickly got attention on social media from Sean King, the NAACP, and others. Divided States focuses on hate crimes and racism affecting communities in the United States and Europe. The second episode looked at Portland, the attacks on the MAX train in May of last year, and the lasting impact of that trauma on survivors, the families of the victims, and the community. Micah Fletcher, who has taken up boxing as part of his recovery, survived a knife wound to the throat. And the girls who were initially targeted are also working to recover from the trauma. A fact that is all too clear at one especially heartbreaking point in the documentary when Destiny Magnum's mom cries while listening to her daughter say that she wishes it had been her who died instead of Ricky Best and Tala'esi Namkaimeche. A&E didn't get everything right in this episode, but their efforts may serve to advance the conversation around racism in Portland and how local institutions are failing to protect Portlanders. The first three episodes can be streamed online on A&E's website at www.aetv.com.
A conference today in Portland will explore the many advantages of hiring older workers, people with disabilities, and veterans. KBOO reporter Pete Zimmerman, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, has more.
A conference today in Portland will explore the many advantages of hiring older workers, people with disabilities, and veterans. AARP Oregon is hosting the event on non-traditional workers, a pool of employees that may be going untapped in Oregon's tight labor market. Unemployment in Oregon is at 4%, which might leave some employers struggling to find employees. Keynote speaker Dr. Kevin Cahill from the economic firm Eco Northwest says older workers bring many benefits to the table.
The cohort of the baby boomers is much more educated than prior cohorts were. Older workers just have a lifetime of experience. They've just been on planet Earth a lot longer than younger workers, and they bring that to the workplace. There's lots of evidence that older workers are healthier than older workers were in the past.
Cahill says many Americans are working longer because there are incentives to do so. There's a decline in how much people are saving, and people are preparing for longer lifespans than generations past. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler also spoke at the event. Eco Northwest and Easter Seals Oregon, a group that provides services for children and adults with disabilities, co-sponsored the conference. U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley also touts the benefits of older workers, although he says they face many stereotypes that can be barriers to getting hired.
The resources and training, older workers are as capable as anyone of working in today's high-tech workforce. And because Americans are living longer, healthier, more active lives, almost 19% of individuals 65 and older are now pushing off retirement to do so.
Merkley says the Senior Community Service Employment Program is helping older Americans make ends meet. The federal program helps people 55 and older return to the workforce through paid, on-the-job training. He also says people with disabilities face stereotypes, but that these workers actually have a lower turnover rate and higher productivity in the workplace. For KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I'm Peter Zimmerman.
Oregon's January employment numbers are out. Thomas Rush, public affairs specialist for the Oregon Employment Department, discusses the numbers with state employment economist Nick Balichicks.
Oregon's January employment figures have been released, and Oregon's unemployment rate is unchanged at 4.1%, according to the Oregon Employment Department. Here's economist Nick Balichicks.
Oregon's unemployment rate has been low and stable for a while now, but it's at record low levels. That 4.1% is the lowest since comparable records began in 1976. This isn't the first time we've seen that low of unemployment rate. In fact, the unemployment rate has been 4.1 to 4.2% since January of 2017.
Oregon added 5,000 jobs over the month, continuing recent trends.
Over the last 12 months, Oregon added 50,600 jobs for a job growth rate of 2.7%. So we picked up from a lull in the summer when growth had slowed. Now it's picked up again.
Next week, the Oregon Employment Department will release local employment numbers. Reporting from Salem, this is Will Burchard.
Get your accountability boots on, Portland. Tomorrow is the monthly public hearing of the Citizen Review Committee. The CRC is part of City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, which is the starting point for citizen-initiated complaints against the police. The CRC is made up of trained volunteers who, among other duties, hear appeals of citizen complaints that have not been sustained by the Bureau. Tomorrow's appeal hearing was brought by a man who alleges that, while being arrested at a bar last summer for refusing to leave, an officer used unnecessary force after the appellant was already on the ground with his arms pinned behind him. The officer in question, called Officer A, said that the appellant's hands being beneath him and out of sight constituted a, quote, officer safety concern. After giving several knee strikes to the appellant's back, Officer A says both officers pried the appellant's hands out from under him and made the arrest. Officer A's unit commander issued findings in the case last October, exonerating the officer with a debriefing. In this case, exoneration means that, in the view of the Bureau, the event did occur, but was within policy. The CRC can either affirm the finding or challenge it. If they challenge, they can request either a further debriefing of the officer, or they can refer the case back to the Independent Police Review or Internal Affairs for further investigation. The appeal hearing is tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. in the Lovejoy Room at City Hall.
The Northwest Accountability Project planned to stage a press conference and demonstration today highlighting New Seasons Market's ties to the Murdoch Charitable Trust. The project is backed by New Seasons employees and Representative Bob Nasi. The Murdoch Charitable Trust invests in Endeavor Capital, the majority owner of New Seasons, and it is claimed to have funded causes against LGBTQ people, women, and the environment. The trust has previously supported the Alliance Defending Freedom, a group that backed North Carolina's anti-transgender bill, as well as the Portland Fellowship, the only organization in Oregon to offer gay conversion therapy. The protest comes just a week after New Seasons employees raised questions about who Endeavor Capital invests in.
A group of interfaith DACA activists were arrested yesterday during a sit-in outside the House Speaker Paul Ryan's Washington, D.C. office. KBOO reporter Hannah Pearl has more.
It was an honor to be arrested with you. So said Dallas Muslim preacher Omar Suleiman, one of more than a dozen interfaith activists arrested at the nation's capital on Monday. The group staged a peaceful sit-in at the offices of the Speaker for the House, Paul Ryan, to demand protection for DACA recipients. Their request was simple: stand with the people and bring a DACA bill to the House floor. One man traveled from California to deliver his message to Paul Ryan.
So I am here to say to Paul Ryan, I don't know how many more years I have on this earth, but if he does not bring the Dream Act to the floor and pass the bill, I will dedicate the rest of my year to making sure that this is his last year, his last year in office. And in November, we will replace him with a candidate who is willing to stand with Muslims and stand with Jews and stand with young immigrants and stand with working people all across this country, rather than standing with K Street and the banks and the KKK. So Paul Ryan, I'm going to knock on your door one more time, and I want you to answer it.
The activists comprised of several prominent leaders from a variety of national organizations. Members from the Women's March, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and various LGBTQ organizations, and the Jewish action group Bend the Arc, banded together to urge Congress to stand against Trump's efforts to end the DACA program. Prior to being arrested, speakers attempted to reach out to Paul Ryan through closed doors.
And I am proud to be standing here with all of our communities together, Muslim, Jews, Christians, women, LGBTQ people, all of us together to say clear that we need a solution. Congress needs to stop playing with our lives. We are not going to stop fighting. They thought that they will bury us. They did not know we were seeds. We will continue to grow our movement. They're not going to take the humanity and the dignity and the joy of our people away. And we are going to continue to take action together, not only in direct action like we're doing today and demanding that Congress does its job and do what we elected them for, but also at the polls.
That's right.
So you're going to hear from us with our votes and with our actions, and we will not stop.
Omar Suleiman, a professor of Islamic studies at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, encouraged activists to keep applying pressure to what he called the racist regime. The dreamers live in fear daily, he continued, while these politicians treat them like chess pieces. With haunting voices, the group sang in solidarity while plastic zip ties cuffed their wrists together. The activists were arrested on charges of civil disobedience and released after about 5 hours in jail. This is Hannah Pearl with KBOO News.
The city of Portland has been facing an ongoing homeless crisis for several years now. KBOO's Al Khan has some thoughts on the matter.
Early in the morning on February 2nd this year, police swept through a budding homeless camp on the Columbia River Slough. The residents were calling it the Village of Hope. However, their hopes were dashed. Mayor Wheeler had spoken, saying, quote, "Parks and natural areas are not appropriate places to build. Parks belong to everyone. The area is hardly a park-like setting." The experimental camp was modeled after Dignity Village, which opened in 2001, housing up to 60 people and policing themselves. In Portland, we are facing a homeless crisis. We need solutions. 1,800 people are on the streets of Portland, with nowhere to sleep except for under bridges, in parks, sidewalks, small tent cities. It's time now to call for a solution, any solution, not throw one away. Hope. Village of Hope. That's what these people desperately need, and that's what we should be giving them. Not promises, not empty words. Hope. Mr. Wheeler, You've said yourself we have a crisis. I think it's time for you to do something about it. Stand up, show these people what hope truly is. Give them their dignity back. They don't want a hand out. They want a hand up. Please, show them compassion and give them hope. I'm Al Khan, and I thank you for your attention.
Not since the days of Oedipus and the Sphinx has there been a riddle more riveting. It's time for this week's point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to write down a spice, draw a single line segment, and you now have an article of clothing. As an additional hint, I said that the two words do not rhyme. Well, the answer is cloves. Draw a line on the C to get gloves. Our winner this week is Daryl McKeel, who listens to KYAQ in Newport, Oregon.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
For the new puzzle, start with an instrument in two syllables. Spoonerize the syllables, and phonetically, you will now have another musical term. By spoonerize, I mean to swap the leading consonant sounds. For example, a cozy nook would become a nosy cook. So again, start with an instrument in two syllables, spoonerize the syllables, and phonetically, you now have another musical term. When you know the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance.
This has been Pearl Stark with your point puzzle for the week of March 5th. The point puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
If I rule the world, every day would be the first day of spring. Every heart would have a new song to sing, and we'd sing of the joy every morning would bring.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with a peer advocate from the mental health community who will be discussing police oversight. At 6, it's Trans Positive. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For tonight's weather, expect a chilly night with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1888, author and Civil War nurse Louisa May Alcott passed away. She was just 55 years old. She is most famous for her book Little Women, which challenged the stereotypes of the day, offering a young heroine in the form of Jo March. It remains to this day a classic of children's literature. The quote of the day is also from Miss Alcott, who said, "We all have our own life to pursue, our own kind of dream to be weaving, and we all have the power to make wishes come true as long as we keep believing."
No, my friend, not if I rule the world, every head would be held up high.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, public allegations emerge about inappropriate sexual behavior by author Sherman Alexie, a coalition of tribes react to revelations about the Trump administration's motives for reducing Bears Ears National Monument, and the Navajo Nation is working to expand the Amber Alert system to Native lands.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. Three women have come forward publicly in a national public radio story accusing Native American author Sherman Alexie of sexual misconduct. The NPR story indicates three women spoke on the record, but the reporters talked to 10 women total. They allege a pattern of behavior in which Alexie used his status as a famous writer to lure the women into sexual situations. The allegations range from inappropriate comments to unwanted advances. Some of the women say the behavior led to consensual encounters that abruptly ended. As talk about accusations increased last week, Alexie issued a blanket statement admitting that he has harmed others. Alexie did not provide details, but said there are women telling the truth and apologized to the people he hurt. National Native News reached out to Alexie's publicist, but did not have a response before deadline. Alexie is Coeur d'Alene Indian and grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation. He is one of the country's best-known Native American poets and writers, winning the National Book Award in 2007 for his young adult novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. He also wrote the screenplay for the film Smoke Signals, based on his short stories. Representatives for tribes fighting President Trump's executive order reducing Bears Ears National Monument boundaries say they're appalled by new revelations indicating mining and oil and gas development drove the process. A coalition of five tribes that worked in favor of establishing federal monument protections issued a statement accusing the Trump administration of improperly relying on state and congressional elected leaders and extraction companies in setting new boundaries. Sean Chapoos, chairman of the Ute Indian Tribe Business Committee, says the administration's actions show disrespect to the tribes, who should have more of a say in the decision.
Simple fact is, I wasn't shocked, but it just more or less verified what we already knew was happening, you know, during this whole process.
Chapoos says the new information adds fuel to the lawsuit by tribes and others claiming the president's decision overstepped his authority and was based on inadequate input. Late last week, the New York Times printed a story based on emails by agency officials and elected leaders. The Times says the messages reveal mining and oil development were key to the final decision on the monument boundaries. Navajo Nation officials say they're one step closer to improving emergency notifications when children are abducted or go missing. The U.S. House of Representatives approved the bill to expand Amber Alert systems on tribal lands. Many reservations lack emergency notifications in cases of missing or abducted children, KNAU's Ryan Heinches reports.
The bill makes Department of Justice grants and other training programs available to establish Amber Alert systems on often remote reservations. It would also integrate tribes with state and county notifications. The bill was named for 11-year-old Ashlyn Mike, who was abducted and murdered near Shiprock, New Mexico, on the Navajo Nation in 2016. Nearly a day passed after she disappeared before an alert was issued. The tribe installed its own notification system last month. Harlan Cleveland is the Amber Alert Coordinator for the Navajo Department of Emergency Management.
Time is of the essence in any emergency, especially in a child abduction. And once law enforcement gets on scene, conducts their investigation, interviews people, we're able to push that alert a lot faster, get that information out to safely recover that child.
The U.S. Senate in November passed its own version of the Amber Alert legislation, introduced by Arizona Republican John McCain. The House bill now goes back to the Senate for its consideration. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And I'm Daisha Eaton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
Last year, during two separate television appearances, White House counselor Kellyanne Conway violated the Hatch Act of 1939. The act, named for former New Mexico Senator Carl Hatch, is meant to prohibit employees of the executive branch of the government from engaging in political activity. The president, vice president, and certain high-ranking officials are exempted from the act. During the Senate race to replace Jeff Sessions, Conway appeared on Fox and Friends and on CNN's Newsday. During both appearances, she made remarks criticizing Doug Jones and appearing to favor Alabama Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore. During her Fox appearance, she blasted Jones, saying, quote, "Jug Jones in Alabama, folks, don't be fooled. He will be a vote against tax cuts. He is weak on crime, weak on borders," end quote. During her CNN appearance, Conway stated that Donald Trump doesn't want a liberal Democrat representing Alabama in the Senate. Walter Schaub, the former director of the Office of Government Ethics, called Conway's comments a, quote, "slam dunk" violation of the Hatch Act. Her boss, Donald Trump, will now decide what disciplinary action Conway will face.
Donald Trump is about to find out that it's a lot easier to fake Time magazine covers than Nobel Peace Prize nominations. The Nobel Committee has announced that a submission made by an unidentified American nominating Donald Trump for the Peace Prize is fraudulent. The committee said they could not give more details as commenting on nominations as it would violate their status. However, a police report has been filed on the incident. The submitted nomination reportedly considered Trump to be worthy of the prize due to his ideology of, quote, "peace by force." This is the second time a questionable nomination has been submitted for Trump. Last year, a similar nomination was received by the committee, though it was not disclosed to the public. People eligible to submit nominations are heads of state, college professors, Nobel Committee members, and former recipients.
It's been almost 4 years since residents of Flint, Michigan had safe, reliable drinking water. The government has been slow to solve the problem, and so the nation's activists have taken up the task. Among those working to keep Michiganders safe are Will and Jaden Smith. The father and son recently announced that their company, Just, has vowed monthly donations of bottled water to Flint schools until the city's water is drinkable again. The company has already donated 9,200 bottles to Flint. The city's pipes are dangerously corroded, polluting the water with high levels of lead. In 2017, the EPA gave Flint a $100 million grant to start replacing its pipes. The project is scheduled for completion in 2020.
Patients who take opioids fare no better over the long term than patients who take other pain medications, according to a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The year-long study showed that opioids work no better than the over-the-counter alternatives in patients with backaches and hip or knee arthritis. The study comes at the height of the opioid epidemic, with the Center for Disease Control stating that an average of 115 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose.
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Language matters. For example, the words that corporate and government officials use to report on the health of America's economy can either make clear to us commoners what's going on, or hide and even lie about the reality we face. Consider the most common measurement used by officials and the media to tell us whether our economy is zooming or sputtering: Wall Street's index of stock prices. The media literally spews out the Dow Jones average of stock prices every hour, as though everyone is waiting breathlessly for that update. But wait, nearly all stock is owned by the richest 10% of Americans, so the Dow Jones average says nothing about the economic condition of the 90% majority of Americans. For us, and for the true economic health of America as a whole, we need to know the Doug Jones average. How are Doug and Dolores doing? Well, as we've seen, stock prices keep rising to new highs, while wages and living standards of the middle class and poor majority have been held down by the same corporate and political leaders telling us to keep our eye on the Dow. To disguise this decline, they play another dirty language trick on us when they issue the monthly unemployment report. Currently, with the unemployment rate down to 4%, they tell us America's job market is booming. But wait again. That only reflects the number of jobs, not the dollar value of those jobs in terms of wages and benefits. Having lots of people doing poorly paid work is hardly a healthy job market. Notice that they don't measure the stock market by the number of stocks out there, but by their value. And they should measure our job market the same way in order to give an honest picture of how Doug and Dolores are doing. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, they'd only do that if they gave a damn about all of us Dougs and Doloreses. And that speaks volumes about their bias for stock-owning elites.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
European Union CO2 goals have influenced Germany's decision to allow cities to impose bans on driving diesel vehicles, a decision that could greatly affect car makers in Germany and Europe. While diesel has been shown in a more efficient have been shown more efficient, it also produces more toxic nitrogen oxides and particulates more than regular gasoline. The issue is controversial. Diesel efficiency has been elemental in reducing greenhouse gases, and European CO2 emissions have risen since the early stages of diesel decline. Yet it's not enough. French car makers have relied heavily on diesel to meet emission requirements in the past and are now scrambling to come up with new solutions. Changing vehicle production this late in the game is believed by some to be potentially trigger the next auto recession. Hybrids and electric cars will likely be the solution, but charging stations will be costly, and the profitability of going electric in general could have unforeseen ramifications in the European market.
After a visit from South Korean politicians, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has stated that the country will freeze its nuclear missiles programs if the U.S. agrees to direct talks aimed at easing the threats to North Korean security. While North Korea feels its security depends on its development of nuclear power, the U.S. claims any talks will be centered on North Korea abandoning its nuclear program entirely. Talks should therefore be seen as a step in the right direction, but also to proceed with a healthy amount of caution. North Korea has pledged not to threaten or attack South Korea, and the leaders of both countries plan to meet in April in an attempt to ease military tensions between the two countries and their allies. Kim Jong-un very rarely hosts foreign visitors, and his recent meeting with South Korean officials seems to mark his desire to come to new relations with his southern neighbors and the U.S.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from Rick Smith. Today, Rick schools us on International Unemployed Day.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day hundreds of thousands of activists and unemployed poured into the streets worldwide for International Unemployed Day. It was a coordinated campaign to protest conditions created by the stock market crash just 4 months earlier. Workers and the poor were the first to feel the most devastating impacts of what would quickly become the Great Depression. Organized primarily by communists, the day's actions highlighted the work of the newly formed unemployed councils and had mass appeal. The unemployed councils worked to distribute food, prevent evictions, secure utilities, and link the needs of the unemployed to the trade unions. The councils mobilized the unemployed in support during the strikes as a way to stop scabbing. They organized hunger marches and protests at relief offices. Tens of thousands came out in every city for the Unemployed Day demonstrations. In North America, cities like Boston, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Seattle, and San Francisco all drew massive crowds estimated at 40 to 50,000 each. Protesters demanded jobs and unemployment insurance. In Chicago, tens of thousands overwhelmed the streets for more than 12 hours. In Detroit and New York City, competing organizers challenged the crowd estimates, with as many as 100,000 turning out in each city. Confrontations broke out between protesters and the police in both cities. Across the country, many of the unemployed were arrested or hospitalized. In New York City, outraged communist activists asserted that protesters were met with water hoses, tear gas, and guns as they marched down Broadway to City Hall. Critics argued that the crowd estimates were wildly exaggerated. But the day of action forced governments around the world to acknowledge deteriorating conditions and the devastating impact of the Great Depression.
Climate Connections focuses on how climate change affects our daily lives. Today, they are taking a look at how ski resorts are teaming up to fight profit-killing climate changes.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Ski resorts depend on snow, but with global warming, some slopes are seeing more rain and less of the white stuff. And warmer temperatures make it harder for resorts to make their own snow.
These can impact our operations, the length of the season, and ultimately our revenues.
That's Geraldine Link with the National Ski Areas Association. To help address the problem, her group launched the Climate Challenge, in which resorts pledged to advocate for climate solutions and reduce their own carbon pollution. Since the program started in 2011, more than 40 resorts have participated. Their strategies for reducing emissions range from adding solar panels to retrofitting lighting systems and grooming the slopes with hybrid vehicles. In total, the resorts have reduced their greenhouse gas emissions by 44,000 metric tons. That's equivalent to taking more than 9,000 cars off the road for a year.
We're very hopeful that we'll have more participants coming on board this year, especially with the fact the United States is out of the Paris Climate Agreement. We feel that the need for voluntary action has never been greater than now.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's time for CurrentCast, the podcast produced about the road to cleaner water.
On the road to cleaner water, on this CurrentCast. When you set out on a road trip, the first thing you do is find your starting point on a map and set a destination. Watershed groups use a similar approach for restoration projects. First, they establish a starting point. How bad is the pollution and what's causing it? Then they set a destination using what's called a total maximum daily load, or TMDL. Bill Brown of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection says a TMDL outlines how much pollution the water can handle and still meet clean water goals.
TMDL serve as planning tools that provide the target and give some insight into the major pollutant sources.
Helping answer the question, are we there yet? CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Pete Zimmerman, Elizabeth Venable, Hannah Pearl, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Jasmine Moneymaker. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seaway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Kyle, and coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary with host Paul Rowland. At 9, it's The Politics of Living, women's voices and opinions on political and cultural issues. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show looks at just how effective biketivism can be at achieving social change. Support KBOO's Kickstarter. Go to kboo.fm Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm Kickstarter.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This week, a forum hosted by the mayor's office saw members of the city bureaucracy taking questions from the public on public safety. Specifically, the city wanted to focus on the PCEP, or the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, a long overdue replacement for the Community Oversight Advisory Board, or COAB, which folded last year amid internal disagreement and official neglect. However, there were many in the audience who tried to get officials to answer questions on other topics, a prominent one being mental health and police response to people experiencing mental health crises. I spoke this afternoon with Anne, a peer advocate in the mental health community in Portland, who has had extensive experience working with grassroots advocates, government bureaucrats, and the police over the years. She asked that we not use her last name at this time. Thank you for being here and talking with me today.
I wanted to start, if you could tell me a little bit about your experience with the public side of treatment for mental health.
Actually, I used to teach at local colleges and universities. I was adjunct faculty. And at that time, because I had the diagnosis of bipolar, I could not buy any insurance. I had enough money. And it was very, very difficult to get any kind of health care. So after a while, I would need mental health care at some points, and I couldn't get it. Or I would end up in a situation where I needed extra care. And sometimes my family actually took care of me at home because they worried about me getting those bills like my friends did of $50,000, $60,000 because they were uninsured. So they actually did home health care, like inpatient care at their house, taking care of me. And after a while, I actually got in the civil commitment system and caught up in that. And then I got into the public mental health system.
Could you explain a little bit about what civil commitment is? I think it's not exactly a household term for our listeners.
I hope not.
Yeah.
So civil commitment happens, and every county has different regulations in Oregon. And so it is if someone determines that you're dangerous to yourself, perhaps to yourself or to others, the first way into that system is that you're going to be in a hospital situation. The doctor will take away your civil rights, and they can do that for 72 hours. And a local person from the county will come in as investigator and determine if you should go to court or civil court or not.
What are some of the issues that people have with the way the city and state interact with the mental health community?
I can speak as an individual. I will not speak for everybody.
Yeah.
We are a new civil rights movement. We've been in existence for about 30 years. And we do have people who do speak for us, but we're not voted on, so we're not representatives. But I can speak from my own experience of being an advocate in the system, with systems. And I personally have been involved since 2006 with the Portland Public Police Department and volunteering and helping them out. Mayor Potter asked me to be on a commission with them, a public safety commission, after a death happened in Portland. And since then, I have personally watched the police people I have worked with, volunteered with, grow and actually get more interested in mental health. And in my trainings I have done with the 911 system, 30 to 40%, I believe, of calls of police every day really have to do with mental health. So on an everyday basis, they are actually doing calls and doing a fairly good job, I think, with people on an everyday basis. I hear good stories from families and people as well. There are the other stories, too. You had talked about the police system speaking with the grassroots leaders. And as far as I know, we have never been invited since 2006, since I've been personally involved, to meet with the mayor, to meet with the leaders, to meet with the sheriff, to meet with the chair of Multnomah County, all these people who have to do with providing mental health care, providing safety for the public, providing safety for those of us with mental health challenges. We've never been invited.
Have you had any substantial response to any questions or comments that you personally have directed at the city or the police bureau?
We were talking about the COAB process.
Yeah.
COAB, meaning, let's explain what that is. What does that stand for?
The COCAL is the
Community Oversight Advisory Board.
Oversight Community Liaison. Yeah. And the COAB is the Community Oversight Advisory Board, and they're the sort of twin pillars of oversight of the settlement agreement process with the U.S. Department of Justice and the City of Portland regarding police use of force against people in mental health crises.
So when this happened years ago, when the suit, the Department of Justice came, and I believe it was Mayor Sam Adams, they wrote up some agreements. And Jason Renaud knows much more about this than I do. And in those agreements, there was supposed to be a board. It was actually very different in the United States, something new. I was tangentially involved at that time, and to the City of Portland decided to hire the COCOL, and there were several firms who came to present about the COCOL. I personally wasn't involved, but many of my friends, advocates, and allies, so peer allies of the movement, were involved, and they went to watch, I believe, three or four firms present their ideas of what they would do as a COCOL and decide what to happen. And all the people involved in the mental health peer movement and also the allies told the City of Portland at the time, don't hire any of these firms because it's not going to work. They could tell the future. And they actually told what happened in a way. It's interesting. They foretold it. And they said, none of these firms will understand what's really going on. Please go out and do another national search. And the mayor at that time didn't listen to the grassroots people or the doctors or the others who advised them not to hire any of these COCOLs. They hired the COCOL, and we've seen what happened since then.
And that's the Rosenbaum and Associates from Chicago, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. And regarding the COAB was the community side of this oversight arrangement.
So I decided as an advocate that it would not be beneficial to be part of the COAB because I was part at the table when they're forming, they made a matrix about who could be on the COAB. They decided what kind of people from what places was going to represent what. And at that table, because those of us in the grassroots mental health movement really never have any time in City Hall. We don't know how to play the politics. At that table, which was run by Amanda Fritz, Commissioner Amanda Fritz at the time, everything we said was overrun by other interests at the table. So basically, it seemed from my viewpoint that being part of the COAB wouldn't bring forth solutions for people with mental health issues and the police, because the matrix was not made looking at mental health issues. It was looking at a whole host of issues which need to be looked at, which need to be examined in Portland. And I think that this suit has been a great opportunity to bring up all these other issues, but it hasn't been for mental health. Mental health has actually been on the side table. And the COAB itself, when it was formed, actually they presented some recommendations, which was spoken about at the meeting last week. I believe there's 44 recommendations. And the interesting fact is that only about four of those 44 have to do with mental health.
And this from a settlement process that had a lot to do with mental health.
From our understanding, from those of us on the outside, and what happened too, once that mayor had told us that he wasn't going to listen to our recommendations, the grassroots community just walked away from the process. There were some brave people, Christy Jameson, and some others who joined in the COAB for a while, but because people didn't listen about mental health, she too left. So we just decided to walk away. I personally would go in because I had been on what's called the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council on the Mental Health Subcommittee for 12 years now. And also Commander Sarah Westbrook and Amy Brunert-Dennert, who's believed in Lieutenant, and Lisbeth Gerritsen of the Police Bureau got me involved to help create the Enhanced Crisis Intervention Team. I was on the advisory committee for years. So when I would walk into the COAB meetings, I would see my friends from the police, my friends from even Sharon Myron, who is now commissioner, other people from all these other realms. And I know also that the police were a little bit frustrated because the subject of mental health got overpowered by other topics which need to be spoken about in Portland. Again, it's been a great forum, but this settlement agreement has not really worked with mental health. and I am so grateful to Judge Sliman. Judge Sliman, throughout the process, has tried to make time for those of us with the perspective of making relations better between the police and people with issues better. He's tried that. And the city of Portland has actually worked against that. It's very strange. One of the first meetings of the COAB, which had to do with introducing what the Department of Justice suit was about, and the peer grassroots community was not even invited to speak. So they gave, it was Amy Ruiz from the COCL invited people to speak. And she had the Biden Ministerial Alliance, who spoke for, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes. They had Department of Justice there, who gave a long presentation, PowerPoint presentation. And they gave 5 minutes to speak about mental health. And at that time, they didn't even invite those of us in the peer community or those of us who have been working with the police for 10 years or so. They called Bob Joondeff from Disability Rights Oregon, who's not even a peer. And Bob wrote an email to a bunch of us and said, what do I say? They've asked me to speak, but they're not allowing you to speak. So it was really wonderful. Bob wrote to a lot of us. We wrote to listservs, to the other peers. What do you want Bob to say? He actually read a lot of the things that I wrote and other people did. He spoke for us. I spoke at the community comment time at that time. And behind me was Deanna from the mayor's office. And after the meeting, Deanna said, this was all about mental health. And I looked at her and I was trying to understand what she really meant. What do you mean is about mental health? So I actually tried to ask her that question. For 2 years, I called the office. I left phone messages. I wrote an email. I was just really curious how she saw it was about mental health, and I didn't. I was curious. What was her point? And she never did call me within the 2 years.
Do you see improvements in the way that society at large is talking about this?
I see improvements in that when I was first locked up 30 years ago, we didn't speak about it. My family didn't. My parents had no support. They kept it quiet because it had to be secret. And I'm very happy to see now that people have more support in schools and other places, more spoken openly about. Diagnosis is a very interesting thing. Psychiatry is interesting in the realm of sciences. It's not a hard science. So it's diagnosis still based on things that are more having to do with sometimes what we observe as opinion than fact, because it's hard to say this person has a fact, is fact this way. I've gotten 5 different diagnoses myself, asking my doctor, which one am I really? Because this doctor said that and that doctor said that. So in this mental health grassroots movement, it's happened 30 years, we've learned to use different words. People with lived experience, we use the word peer, but right now peer is used almost everywhere for everybody. So I don't know if that's going to be a good word for mental health. We also use, instead of saying psychosis, using the words extreme state. It's a state, or we talk about also we are out of consensus reality. Because right now, we're in a reality, you and I are sitting in a studio. I agree, and you're agreeing that we're doing it at radio interview right now, right? We agree that we're both in our little worlds, and it's a consensus reality we're doing this. Now, sometimes when I'm not doing well mentally, I will think maybe you're an alien. So my reality doesn't match the consensus because it's non-judgmental. So the peer movement has to do with letting go of judgment, walking with people where they're at, and also being mutually supportive. That's what peer support does, is that we support people where they're at, accepting them where they're at. And sometimes it's hard if people are not in the consensus reality, but we as peers accept people for who they are at that moment and ask them what they want, what they need, and get them the support to empower themselves to get out of the states and be healthy.
Do you see any points of light or active avenues for improving that government programs, in the legislature or in the city?
I do see lots of points. There's actually a council called the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council through the state of Oregon that advises the Oregon Health Authority on what to spend money on mental health. There is an advocate, peer advocate, Kevin Fitz, who is in many places in county government and also in state government. But it's a very fine line. How can you be an advocate while working within a system? And Michael Libachuk, who worked for the state of Oregon many, many years, found that trying to find that balance, when do you speak your voice and when do you really work within the system?
Given your experience at the intersection of mental health and the public safety community, how do you feel about the current proposal? Or no, it's not a proposal, it's going forward now, the PCEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, that was presented at that forum last week.
I just have to say, from the mental health community, this, besides Judge Simon, this Department of Justice process hasn't brought out our voices. They haven't listened to us. So I'm happy they have a process, but I don't think it's going to make those between the police and mental health community systems better. We actually are doing that on our own in a way. I listened to the mayor's staff at that last meeting, and they said, this process has been about mental health the whole time. And those of us who, from the grassroots side, looked at this process over the years and said, where has mental health been? It hasn't been addressed. Our questions having to do with it haven't been addressed. However, the police have been working on it proactively, and those of us on the grassroots side working, and things are getting better. There have been deaths. There have been other things happening, and we have to deal with that. But from a mental health perspective, I don't know if that new system is actually going to even bring out any mental health stuff.
All right. Well, that's a note to end on, I suppose. But was there anything you wanted to add? Or
I just feel there's so much hope. On May 20th, the National Alliance on Mental Illness is having a walk. People are meeting from 12 to 1 underneath the Hawthorne Bridge. And even if it's just for one organization that has many perspectives on mental health, we don't all necessarily agree, because mental health is for everybody. One out of four mm-hmm. people in the United States has a mental health emergency in their lifetime. Please come to the walk. 5,000 to 6,000 people there. And it is the one time in Portland when I feel completely supported to be who I am. No matter diagnosed, undiagnosed, whatever. People there accept me for who I am. Families are there with children and loved ones who had people die through the mental health process, have posters of their dead loved ones walking together. Let's all walk together with hope.
I've been speaking with Anne, a peer advocate in the mental health community in Portland. Anne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
And for KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And the time is 5:56, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Transpositive PDX. Consider joining our Kickstarter. We have 3 days left, and let's make media.
Can I get a kick out of you?
KBOO is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Yet I get a kick, yes. I get a kick, yes. I get a kick.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Limp Wrist. Live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. Limp Wrist, four unruly, lewd queens playing hardcore call for all dykes, rough girls, sissy boys, trans folks, leather teos, fierce queens, punks, the non-defined, and the questioning, to come get loose at their only Northwest show. Also playing are Xylitol from Olympia and Portland's Labinden Toten and Petite. Again, that's Limpress, live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Girl.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. I am one of the co-hosts of Transpositive. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
Hi, my name's Guinevere and I use she and her pronouns.
Hi, my name's Nicolette and I use A&M pronouns.
And we're so happy to be here with you tonight on KBOO Community Radio. First of all, I just want to remind everybody about our City of Media Makers, the campaign that's been going on at KBOO for the last couple of weeks, raising money. And you can go to KBOO, go to kboo.fm and find out more about it, and you can make a donation. It's a really great campaign. And as a member of the finance committee at KBOO, I always want to encourage people, please make a donation. This is your community radio station, and with your support, we're able to be on the air 24 hours a day, offering amazing community programming. So what's going on tonight?
Well, I do have a quick announcement. Last year, we had our first national non-binary and genderqueer Pride Day on March 15th, and it was pretty successful, I would say. I saw a lot of posts about it on Facebook and Instagram, so it was really cool to see. As far as I know, that should be happening again this month on March 15th, although I haven't gotten official confirmation yet, but I think everyone should plan on that. Genderqueer and Non-Binary Pride Day, March 15th.
That sounds amazing. That's great. I know I got an announcement about something else. I'm going to look it up here while we're chatting. But we wanted to talk for a few minutes about stuff that was going on locally in the community and maybe even things that are happening nationally. One of the things we were chatting about before the show started was we were talking about something that's kind of going on outside of the community. And it's something that, like, I haven't heard a lot of conversation about, but when Gwen walked in tonight and started chatting about it, I thought, yeah, that's right on. What were you talking about, Gwen?
Well, the show Transparent and the situation with Jeffrey Tamborn and some inappropriate sexual behavior. And, you know, thinking about it, you know, Transparent was a pretty amazing show. The writers, Jill Soloway, Jeffrey, all the actors in that group, they did an amazing job of bringing transgender into